Greetings from BBS Radio, where truth and news still exist in the original form. You're tuned into The Spiritual Politician, the show that's out there to show you where politics, government, and selfishness went wrong, and how you can take action to make it right. I'm Melinda Pillsbury Foster, your host for this hour of insight aimed at making each of us more responsible, more cooperative, and more aware of the spiritual bonds that connect us to each other, no matter what we find to squabble over in the interim. You can call us toll-free from the U.S. to 877-876-5227. You can call from Canada to 888-810-8322. Or you can call us direct to 530-876-3222. This show is carried online, and you may also be able to get it on the air in your local area. To find out if one of those old-fashioned on-the-air stations in your area carries this show, just contact us at bbsradio.com. The website for this show can be found on the BBS Radio site and at spiritualpolitician.blogspot.com. Past shows become available as soon as it is humanly possible on the station archives. And my own blog is titled How the Neocon Stole Freedom and is conveniently located at howtheneoconstolefreedom.blogspot.com. This week, my blog should have come with a little warning. The graphic is potentially toxic, but I decided it went with the theme, which is another look at the neocons. The article is titled Libby, Coulter, John Fund, Delay. Are the neocons finally toast? The graphic is John Fund, appropriately garbed for his next presidential briefing. John put himself on point, so to speak, because he reported on his own online journal that Tom DeLay, whose day in court is still coming, he does remain indicted, was about to be hired for a cushy and profitable gig at CNN. But times have changed for the neocons. And a call from Gene Gaudette of American Politics Journal to CNN revealed that DeLay has no such signature in his future. Poor thing. It was a bad week in neocon land, and so a good week for America. And now other updates from the week just passed. The battle of the Bush Library took an interesting turn this week with the passage of a bill in the House to rescind the presidential order on access to presidential papers. Fletcher's reported this week, quote, the measure which drew bipartisan support and passed by a veto-busting 333-93 margin was among White House-opposed bills the House passed that would widen access to government information and protect government whistleblowers. Today, Congress took an important step toward restoring openness and transparency in government. House Oversight and Government Reform Committee Chairman Henry Waxman said. The Presidential Papers Bill nullified a November 2001 order, criticized by historians, in which Bush allowed the White House or a former president to block release of a former president's papers and put the onus on researchers to show a specific need for many types of records. Among beneficiaries of the Bush order was Bush's father, George H.W. Bush, a former vice president and president. The order gave former vice presidents the right to stop the release of their papers through an executive privilege that previously only presidents could use, and it extended to deceased presidents' designees rights to keep their papers secret indefinitely. Also passed by the House by a 331-94 margin, despite another veto threat, was a bill aimed at bolstering protections of government whistleblowers who report wrongdoing, especially those with private contractors and national security and scientific agencies. A third bill, which passed 308-117, was aimed at speeding requests for government information made under the Freedom of Information Act. The White House stopped short of threatening to veto it, but said it could not support the bill. Now, we can certainly understand why this White House would be nervous about having anyone look at the evidence. Also this week, Americans were arrested while staging a protest at the Appropriations Committee meeting in the Capitol. Chants of defund the war could be heard on the tape, which is available at YouTube. And now our thought for the week ahead. Sometimes doing the right thing is tough. But almost all of us know what the right thing is, no matter how we try to pretend we don't know, can't see it, or try to ignore it when it's inconvenient. Doing the right thing consistently makes the world a better place. Doing the wrong thing brings anger, resentment, and violence. Those choices make each of us who we are and will be. Blowing the whistle on wrongdoing takes guts. As you heard, Congress is now voting to rescind measures that clouded transparency, erecting royal prerogatives for the presidency, and made punitive action against whistleblowers standard operating procedure in the Rovian White House. These changes mark the end of America's reign of terror. We know who the real terrorists are, don't we? Expect more to come. Once those who abuse power begin to lose that power, the response is likely to be powered by suppressed rage. Let's hope for indictments coming soon. Whistleblowers of principle will be joining those who are desperate to trade information for immunity. When Rove squeals, we'll know that the whistle has blown on all of them. Among the bills passed by the House was, as you heard, one that protects whistleblowers. Whistleblowers perform that essential function for us as Americans. Government is huge, and now in the weakening hands of people with an agenda that has nothing to do with service, the well-being of Americans, or even simple honor. Real whistleblowers, the people who see wrong done and risk their professions and sometimes their lives to bring this to our attention, are heroes, putting it on the line for the right thing. Our guest tonight is a whistleblower. His name is Eric Schein. Mr. Schein is a congressionally and presidentially appointed federal officer with the United States Merchant Marines. He's also a man who decided that the wrong things he had witnessed made it essential that he inform on those who have systemically abused their power and so compromised the Merchant Marines and their role to ensure that America remains strong and ready to defend us. Eric was born in San Diego of parents who came from old American stock, having spent many generations in Massachusetts. America and doing the right thing means a lot to Eric Schein. He's here today to tell us his story, a story you need to know. Please welcome Eric Schein. Eric, are you there?
I am. Thank you.
And I'm so glad that you could be with us today. I think this is going to be very illuminating for everybody. But before we get started on that stuff, tell us about yourself, your family, your siblings, your pets, and what matters to Eric Schein.
Oh, that's a little...
Well, I wanted to give you plenty of latitude.
Well, of course, I went to Kings Point, United States Merchant Marine Academy. It's a valid federal and military service academy. It's a sister academy at West Point in Annapolis. My brother went to West Point. My father attended West Point. My uncle went to Annapolis. Another relative, an uncle, was a Speaker of the House, McCormick. I think that was back in the 60s. And as you said, my family was from Boston and Taunton, Massachusetts, Irish and Portuguese. And I guess the Portuguese in me is the seafarer, and the Irish is the little rebel.
Yes, well, Irish certainly have a reputation for that.
As do many, even the English and others.
Well, yes, I mean, where you need to. I have a lot of Scots background, and they certainly, as a matter of fact, I'm a descendant of Robert the Bruce.
Oh, really?
Yes.
I've met someone else who was also a descendant of William Wallace.
Yes, well, of course, he was, you know.
Right.
They were associated, weren't they?
Right. Different sides of the same coin, I guess, to some respect.
Well, eventually, Robert the Bruce did go and make Scotland independent, which was a good thing.
Right.
Yeah. So I've got some of that in my ancestry, too. But you're from San Diego.
Right. And I have, three sisters and a brother and mother, father. My father is since passed on, actually in the midst of all this, which became a pivotal issue. And one of the things that they're trying to use to counter-prosecute me for is how I feel about the death of my father, supposedly, and or how I was treated in regards to just that incident, but that's only a very small portion of everything that's gone on.
Well, what happened to you was that you saw things happen that shouldn't have been happening. You blew the whistle, and then they found a sort of interesting way to deal with you to shut you up. That's right,
yeah.
Right?
Well, I mean, effectively, if you think about it, like others like Sybil Edmonds, and I'm sure your listeners are hopefully familiar with her story or a little bit about it. She was a federal contractor, which is a little bit different than my situation. She's still supposed to have the same type of protections as a federal employee. And she came out and blew the whistle on who's involved in all the goings-on financially. And, you know, they placed a gag order on her, Ashcroft did, after the fact, after she'd already blown the whistle and gotten information out. And it's kind of like putting the finger in the dike after all the water's come through, or to some respect, after it's already been published, going out and saying, no, you can't have this newspaper because that the information that's in the newspaper is top secret. Well, at some point, it's not anymore. But in her case, they put an actual gag order through the court, and in mine, they've tried to, quote-unquote, gag me by declaring that I'm medically, mentally incompetent.
And, of course, they tried to cite as that the fact that you were depressed because your father died, which, of course, hey, who's ever depressed because their father died? I mean, really.
Right, and you can't prosecute somebody for that or charge them, whether it be under administrative law or, you know, proper statutory law or even precedent. That goes to much of what's going on, and you can talk about Rove and others, of the criminal nature of this administration and those involved. Not all. I mean, there are some good people that, you know, interestingly enough, still embedded within this administration, but many of the people at the top, and you can look to individuals even such as Colin Powell, have been involved in setting up the parameters for war profiteering on such a scale as to never have been seen before on the planet Earth, let alone in our own country.
Colin Powell has, you know, people think well of him, but he actually was involved with Mulai. He was one of the people who covered it up.
Right.
Which, you know, always made me, he gave me pause for thought.
Well, he actually went before Congress and advocated for it's a financial instrument that they use for war profiteering and privateering called block funding. And basically what it does, and when I saw this, I was just blown away. The scales fell from my eyes as far as my belief that Colin Powell was an honest and decent man, because he was actually going in and advocating for, whether he knew it or not, and I believe he did know.
So he's not stupid, so you have to assume that he would.
Right, and just like the whole thing with the weapons of mass destruction and the mobile trailers or whatever, the nerve agent and, you know, gas or whatever that they went before the United Nations on, which has all turned out to be bogus. But the block funding is a financial instrument to where they basically say, okay, we need 10 ships, like an Aegis-class destroyer. They're about $1 billion a pop, excuse me. So we need 10 of them. That would be $10 billion. Just give us the money. Let us worry about getting the ships. We'll provide them to you. But line item accounting and budget people and all this other stuff we don't need because that's just an additional cost. So just give us the money and we'll give them to you as if they're off the shelf, which goes towards waste, fraud, you know, corruption, false claims or QI-TAM violations, federal contracting violations of an untold level. You know, much like in our own Civil War, where these war profiteers and privateers would be contracted by the federal government to provide a box of bullets, they would ship a box with no bullets and still demand payment. And
well, sure, because they wanted, it was all about show me the money. It had
nothing to
do with making sure that they had, you know, fulfilled their contract.
Right, and you've seen that even in Halliburton and KBR, where they've put in for 14,000 meals that they never served, and this administration has come forth in contrast to what the Inspector General's offices were attempting to do and said, just pay it. The war is crazy.
Well, it's very clear that for them, it's for Halliburton, it's show me the money. And, of course, this last week we heard the announcement that Halliburton will be going to Dubai, and it certainly looks like they're trying to avoid accountability because it's harder to serve papers on them when they're offshore.
Well, right, and if you're, you know, basically in charge of a pirate ship, and the government and or people of the country are coming after you, what are you going to do?
Yes, well, I think they've told us what they're going to do. They're going to leave.
Yeah, you're going to get your pirate ship and all your belongings and try to put as many stores on board and as much weaponry and firepower that you can and resources and hightail it out of Dodge City.
That's right, and we can, I guess, expect that they're going to be moving a lot of related things. As a matter of fact, it's going to be interesting to watch who decides to leave and go there, because that will tell you something about their associations that we might not have been picking up on yet.
Well, and even in my own situation, we're now the vice commandant, a vice admiral of the Coast Guard, and you have to understand I'm not in the Coast Guard, but I'm being prosecuted under administrative law by the Coast Guard for supposedly, quote-unquote, being depressed.
Let's just for a minute give people your background. So you went to the Merchant Marine Academy, and you said that's at King's Point.
Yes.
And before that, you actually already, you know, had very strong feelings about ethics and appropriateness and doing the right thing and your obligation, because you had been an Eagle Scout.
Well, and I went to Catholic grade school and high school, you know, parochial schools, and the nuns really whip it into you, so to speak.
They told you, right? You will do the right thing.
I mean, it's just being brought up a certain way, a certain fashion, and it is very structured. And, you know, after going to even some of the things that I was exposed to at the academy, were eye-opening experiences, things that I was not necessarily prepared for in parochial schools, because our public school system is entirely different than private school or parochial school.
Mm-hmm.
You do live in a very sheltered, and it's one reason, like, even if you look at the FBI, they used to love to hire Mormons because of how they were raised and their, you know, religious beliefs. Very devout, and they would actually bring them in because they were difficult to corrupt.
Mm-hmm. And that's a good thing. And so that's the kind of background you have. I mean, you're not the kind of person who was going to be corrupted.
Well, and not, you know, we're all human, and I have my own foibles. I'm not perfect, but I strive, you know, to try to do the right thing and not just think of myself, but also think of, and I think that's one thing that in going to a federal academy, my education was paid for by the U.S. taxpayers, $180,000 education, much like many of the other federal academies. And at some point, you're trained to think a little, you know, the bigger picture.
Mm-hmm.
And to some respect, even, you know, even as a whistleblower or anyone else out here, most understand that when you stick up for yourself, you're sticking up for other people, and that an injury to one is an injury to all.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I want to ask you a question that it just occurred to me. You, as an Eagle Scout, you did a project.
Yes.
What was your project?
It was collecting food, bedding, clothing, blankets, and everything else we could come up with for a mission down in Mexico.
Mm-hmm. Did you then go down
there? Yeah, we loaded it all up in trucks and then took it down there. And we organized the drive through the local Catholic church that I, you know, was attending as a student.
That's a great project.
Yeah, no, it was very awakening and very rewarding. And, you know, it teaches you some very excellent skills.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Gerald Ford was and a lot of people are trashing Gerald Ford nowadays for whatever reason, but he was an Eagle Scout.
Mm-hmm. Well, there have been a lot of really great Americans who were Eagle Scouts. The scouting program has done a tremendous amount for Americans. It gives boys a context to show them what's appropriate and what's more than just appropriate, what's honorable.
Yes. Well, you learn, like, not only through citizenship in the community, like a skill award or a merit badge, citizenship in the nation, citizenship in the world, and all of these other, because they're not just necessarily about camping or hiking, it's about being a good, well-rounded citizen and or human being.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. And that was the whole point of the scouting programs.
Yes.
And that's a very impressive ceremony they do when you when you're given your Eagle Scout.
Yes.
So was it? Did you have that in San Diego?
Yes, my brother was also an Eagle Scout, and then my father was involved in the troop, and Troop 272.
Yeah, so that it becomes part of your life. It's something that you just never really leave behind because you sort of internalize the values.
Well, that's almost like. And I don't know if this is necessarily appropriate, and excuse me if it's, but it's like your first girlfriend.
Uh-huh.
And obviously for a woman, her first, you know, real boyfriend. It's one of those, it's your first accomplishment, like big accomplishment, and it's something that you never lose.
Right.
You never forget.
No, how could you? Because it, you know, it helps define exactly who you are.
Right.
Yeah, and so you had that. You were an Eagle Scout, and then you applied to the Merchant Marine Military Academy at Kings Point, and were accepted.
Well, there was more. I'm also a recovering alcoholic. I've got 24 years, I believe, or 24 years of sobriety.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I actually was drinking, gave up drinking before going into the academy, and even my entrance was somewhat interesting in and of itself, but I was able to get in, and, you know, barring everything that had gone on, I actually was sober about 18 months before getting into the academy, and because of my drug and alcohol statement with the Defense Investigative Services, they were, because they had actually over-recruited and had more cadets than they were supposed to, they tried to start cutting back wherever they could. They called my home, my family's home, and said, you know, don't show up. And we were already on the way. My parents had rented a motorhome, and we were headed out there, and got the call from my sister what was going on. We went to the academy, to Naval Science. We have Naval Sciences on board. They teach us about, you know, because we come out with a Naval Commission and more. Out of the academy, we also have a Coast Guard license as either an engineer or a mate. We work our way up to either being a chief engineer or a captain. And but the went to Naval Sciences, dealt with the captain there, and told him what had gone on, and you know, told him my story. And my parents stuck up for me, and they allowed me entrance under you know, conditions. They had Defense Investigative Services checking out my whole background. Doing thorough, you know, going to family and friends and neighbors and everybody else, and doing somewhat intensive interviews with me. They allowed me to enter with the plebe class, but I was not able to swear in with the plebe class. But 6 months later, after they completed the investigation, I was able to swear in individually within the captain's office in Naval Sciences on board the academy.
Well, that must have been kind of hard on you.
Oh, yeah, and it hasn't gotten easier since.
No, and you must have been pretty young when you were having an alcohol problem.
Yeah, well, I'm Irish.
Oh, well, I guess, you know, I don't think about that. But I guess that is supposed to go with the territory.
Yeah, so, and I guess when we do it right.
Yeah, so, but you went through, I mean, you got through with honors?
Not honors. I graduated. Coming out of Kings Point, it's actually an achievement just to get out of there. It has one of the highest attrition rates of any college or university in the nation. We have more people drop out. It's similar to all the other, or it's the same as all the other academies, except that all the other academies, the age limit is 22 for entrance. Kings Point is 25. But also coming out of Kings Point, you can enter into any of the other branches of service. It's a little bit easier. Like if you go into West Point, you're pretty much going into the military.
Right.
You can go into the Marines, you can go into the Air Force, but it's very, very unusual. And you'd have to have, you know, some good reason for it. You could go into the CIA or something else or FBI, but normally that's not the case.
Mm-hmm.
And so coming out of Kings Point, though, we have that. We get the Naval Commission, but a good majority of our graduates go into all branches of service.
Mm-hmm. So you came out of Kings Point. You um, You did go into the Merchant Marines.
Well, I graduated with the Naval Commission, top secret security clearance, my engineering license and degree, marine engineering, and started to sail in the industry, only to find out that it was under what they've done, which is similar to what they had done in World War II, was they've handed over the maritime industry and even the shipping halls to the mafia.
How long was it that you were in before you started to realize what was going on to the Merchant Marine?
Well, right away you learn that something's wrong. You really don't know what. But even sailing as a cadet for many of these shipping companies like Matson, Crowley, American Present Lines, and more, even as a cadet you start to realize that there's, you know, things going on in the industry that are not right, and you know, you're not really sure, because it takes some time not only to learn your job, your profession, but to kind of feel things out and get a feeling for not only how things are supposed to be, but what's wrong with
mm-hmm.
what's going on.
So you started to see that. Give us a sense of exactly what it was you started to see that you knew was not right.
Well, when the shipping halls, which are part of an enormous federal trust that help protect our United States Merchant Marine, where we go in and gain employment, join a vessel, bid on a job as a federal maritime officer, were being protected by baseball bats between two vying groups within the within that Federal Officers Association, you start to get a very good picture. And there's other Federal Officers Associations like the radio operators and others, where the unions are being taken over and the federal trust being stolen and the union dissolved, and then those in charge take, you know, leading the high life down in Florida somehow, and the federal government doing nothing about it.
So you started to have questions. I mean, you saw these things that you knew were improprieties, and that nobody seemed to be questioning it, so you did.
But you're also coming out of school, and you're trying to earn a living and make a life for yourself and a career. And at some point, you know, first coming out of school and first getting in the industry, you start working a couple jobs here and there, and, you know, one job you don't have a problem, and you work with some really cool people, and it's great. And you could work for the very same company, like I've had experiences with Matt's and some excellent people that work for that company, and then some real screwballs. And some of them don't, you know, a lot of them didn't go to either the Federal Academy or the State Maritime Academies. They've come up, quote unquote, through the hawse pipe, have gotten their licenses and their ability to work in the industry through these Federal Officers Associations, and they're of not the same caliber or integrity or even education, let alone intellect, as many of the people that go to not just the Federal Maritime Academy, but even the state academies like Cal Maritime in Vallejo, or Mass Maritime, or Maine Maritime, or Texas A&M, which has a program, and there's a few others. There's about six state-run maritime academies.
Mm-hmm.
Joe Hazelwood, who was the captain on the Exxon Valdez,
mm-hmm.
he went to Fort Schuyler, which is part of the SUNY or State University of New York school system, and it's their maritime academy. It's almost like VMI, like having the Virginia Military Institute, which
yes.
is a state institute or academy, preparing people to serve in. And then VMI is very well respected, as many of these state academies are, but preparing graduates of VMI to go into as officers in the military.
Uh-huh. So
it's analogous.
Okay. Well, here you were. You were working. You were seeing it would be one way on one trip, another way on another trip. During the whole period of time, what you saw was sort of what you could see as a deterioration of conditions, and you started to have questions.
Yes.
Because they did teach you something about, the history.
Well, even Naval Sciences teaches us about the Merchant Marine Act of 1936 that instituted the academy. That's one of our courses. We also have to read and understand and study Alfred Sayer Mahan, who was from the late 1800s. He got into sea power and projection of power. And one important point, besides my own story in the Merchant Marine and what I've seen and experienced, not only what's happened to me, but what I'm trying to blow the whistle about, is I understand, because of my training, that a military fleet, a naval fleet, a deep sea combatant fleet, you know, a navy, follows a commercial fleet. And what we've done is not only hand over to the Chinese the reason to have a deep water navy, a deep water, you know, a military navy, but also the means.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, because now, rather than having 51% of our cargo as carried on American crude, American flagged, American built ships, which also protects our shipbuilding industries and more, and also has American citizens, and oftentimes federal officers to protect those industries embedded within, now 97% of our cargo is carried by foreign flag, with less than 1% of that actually being inspected, and China is pushing Singapore. Singapore has bought up American President Lines. They used to name all their vessels after American presidents.
Mm-hmm.
They now name their vessels APL China, APL Korea, APL Taiwan, et cetera, et cetera. And they sold through administrative action in 1997, and some of this was under the first Bush administration, initiated under the first Bush administration.
So are you talking about Bush Sr. here?
Yes, and also Andrew Card, when he was not chief of staff for this President Bush, who's, you know, retired or resigned since, but he was Secretary of Transportation, and he also went to my academy, and what they had done was through administrative, you know, caveat or decree, sold off our entire federal fleet to themselves overseas. First and foremost, they privatized it, and then they've, you know, outsourced it overseas, so that they've taken this enormous federal trust, much like our fisheries, and sold it to themselves in a very, 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 you know, I don't want to say cute, but a very interesting and somewhat complex, but somewhat straightforward if you, you know anything about our federal government, how it works, and federal contracting and more. They've taken U.S. Treasury assets and handed them to themselves under Article II administrative proceedings, of such an enormous nature, and it leads into what's going on even with the war profiteering and privateering right now. And you realize how important our merchant marine is, where now, again, we have less than 3% carried under American flag, American crew, with federal maritime officers on board. This goes to even our airline industry. They talk about U.S. Marshals. Well, right now, the safest thing to protect our ports and borders, our waterbound borders and our citizens, is to have vessels, because the flag goes to the law. If the vessel is under American flag, then it's covered under American law. If it's under Chinese flag, then it goes to Chinese law.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very important, because it also goes to the United States and our government and or corporations.
Well, it sounds like what you're talking about, that there are really two basic issues here. And one of those issues is the fact that they're taking property that was paid for by, you know, through taxations and by the taxpayers, and they're transferring it into the private ownership of people who certainly haven't paid for it. And that actually represents a component in our overall strategy for ensuring that, you know, American assets are protected.
Meaning that it be held as part of a public trust.
Right, that it should be held as part of a public trust. When it becomes private, then, of course, it can then again be transferred, but the profits that come from that, and I assume that, of course, shipping is going to develop profits, that you know, that money is going to go into private hands.
Right.
So that's really what you're talking about here. You're talking about a broad-based conversion of American assets.
Yes, in entirety, by industry.
Mm-hmm. And it's happening right out in the open. What's the reaction of other people within the merchant marine?
You got to think about it, though. This is not like meatpacking, which, you know, meatpacking goes towards civil defense and national security. Think of mad cow disease. But this is a valid federal and military branch of service that's like outsourcing the CIA, which now I think 75% of their operations are actually outsourced to private contractors, which is mind-boggling. But then going worse and saying, well, we're not just going to outsource it to private contractors. We're going to outsource it to foreign governments and corporations and foreign nationals.
Mm-hmm. Foreign, so that it isn't under American control at all, and it certainly doesn't profit, you know, the profit doesn't flow back to into the general coffers the way that you would expect it to.
Well, it doesn't go towards the public trust, which is the protection of the people in general, rich and poor, under the rule of law, then rather than under the rule of these, you know, royal, self-declared royal families.
Right, and you used a term, and you used the term privatization. Now, is that a term that you picked up, or is that the term that they're actually using internally within the Merchant Marine to explain what's happening here?
No, as I have been fighting this, I understand, because you really have to dig a little bit deeper, and let me, bear with me with this, is you have to understand the nature of how the shipping companies were, not only by our founding fathers, but even in 1936 under FDR and, you know, Congress at the time, they understood that that is a public trust. We work on things called shipping articles, which are valid articles of agreement with the United States that were enacted in 1791. But our vessels under American flag are an enormous public trust. They're an enormous right of way, an international right of way for us to carry on and control and govern to some extent those international rights of way and protect our citizens. And what has happened is that they have moved to, the shipping companies and even my Federal Officers Association, which many people call it a union, but it's not, it's a federal contractor. But the shipping companies are a federal contractor also, much like Halliburton or KBR, but they're a very, very, very special type of federal contractor that signs what's called a general agency agreement.
Right.
They become an agency or arm or extension of the federal government. And when you think about that, that there's a union, quote unquote, or a federal officers association, a federal contractor, that is set up to provide basically a cost plus basis to federal maritime officers representation. And they've stepped into this because of involvement in the mafia and all sorts of other things. But then you start to dig a little bit deeper and you realize that these shipping companies that sign general agency agreements that become an extension of the United States, and this goes towards corporatism or fascism, that's why you're seeing much of what's going on, because a lot of this is actually coming from Admiralty or Maritime or individuals involved in it who don't see a problem with the government and corporations working hand in hand, because that's the type of industry that they've been working in, like Secretary of the Treasury John Snow.
Mm-hmm.
He was head of TSX and Rail and Shipping Company. But these general agency agreements are also, or these shipping companies that sign the general agency agreements are all members of an organization called the Pacific Maritime Association.
Yes.
And guess who else is a member?
Who?
Walmart.
Really?
Right. And so you start to go, wow, whoa, whoa, that's huge. That one issue in and of itself, where the federal government or its agencies and departments are literally in bed together with Walmart, bespeaks volumes of what is going on in our country right now.
Well, yes, I mean, it's the corporatization of government. I mean, government has become an extension of the corporations, and individuals, of course, they don't really have standing. It's the people who have standing are either corporations or the people who are given status because of their corporate relationship.
Right. Well, they're part of the collective, an enormous collective, whether it be a union, an association, a corporation, an agency or department of the government, state or federal, or some other country, that it's the group that gets the rights, but none of the members of the group.
Right. And that, of course, is a completely, what you're doing is changing the form of government right in front of people's eyes without them even realizing it.
Which goes to communism.
Well, it's collectivism, and all kinds of collectivism have a lot in common.
Yes. Fascism, corporatism, capitalism, they're all literally offshoots or, you know, different fruits of the same tree.
Well, it's all a way to redirect wealth.
True.
And in as far as they're able to do that, of course, redirecting quote unquote wealth that way is stealing. That's the word that one would really accurately use for it. It's an elegant way to steal, where the people who are being stolen from stand there and let you do it because they think that it isn't actually stealing.
But it's also in the one term too that fits in with corporatism, fascism, all that is feudalism, which literally all of these go to because it's the creation of a royal class or an aristocracy or oligarchy who believe by who they dine with, who they hang with, and I don't mean Joe Sixpack or, you know, the common working man. And Trent Lott is a perfect example of this. Trent Lott, his claim to fame is that his daddy was a pipe fitter. Not that he was a pipe fitter and that we have a pipe fitter actually in the Senate or Congress, but we have the son of a pipe fitter.
Well, I'm excited.
I know, right?
I don't know why it would make any difference. I mean, Trent Lott, as far as I can tell, was a boob.
It literally, he is. And for him to even have been and maintained an office for this long also bespeaks much of our own political structure to where we've got individuals, because it used to be to where senators and congressmen used to get their full pension after one term. That's all changed to where now they have to work in the rubber stamp factory of our legislature and pump out, much like a factory, laws, rules, and regulations on an almost daily basis.
Well, they have to keep doing it longer. But, of course, they make a very great profit on selling most of those laws to people who would like to chop us up even further.
Yes.
So, you know, and certainly you would want them to be industrious in that endeavor, right? Ha-ha.
Right. So wouldn't you rather have individuals within our legislatures, both state and federal, and even the judiciary to some extent, people who rose from the ranks in all sorts of various employment, whether it be ship fitting, pipe fitting, welding, painting, even, you know, people who do, you know, painting houses, at some respect, those are the kind of people that formed our government in the late 1700s.
Well, you know, what you want is you want people who don't steal for a living.
Sure.
I think that's sort of the bottom line with me. I don't like people to figure out ways they can steal from me just sort of systemically. I think that's sort of wrong. Otherwise,
well,
I don't really care what they did for a living previously.
Well, we've talked about this, though, too, you and I, offline, about not having any vested interest in it, not knowing how to get their hands dirty and have a cause and effect relationship with actually making something and doing something and fighting for the common man rather than the collective.
Well, yes, but I think that, you know, to me, I look at it and I say, well, the credentials I really want people to have is I want them to do the job, I want them to be capable of doing the job, and I want them to be accountable for doing the job.
Granted.
And if they can't do the job, then I want them out of there.
Granted. But who knows more about an industry like, say, shipbuilding than people who work in the industry doing whatever they do, and who are going to be more jealous in all regards and keep those rights and protections and benefits for our own people. First and foremost, not to say that we're going to try to cut everyone else out and not realize that, no, this is a global economy and that, you know, almost... One example I use is we should not, to some extent, have a Hollywood. We should have many Hollywoods.
Well, and actually there's a diversification going on now in all of the comm medias that is driving, you know, some real changes there. And that's, of course, coming about because of the technologies that are sort of, you know, coming into use because of the Internet. And that's a good thing.
Yes.
That's one of the things they're having a hard, because they would like to control it, and they can't figure out a way to make it stop developing so fast that they can't control it, and that makes people
happy.
Well,
they also understand, though, that by imposing that control upon it, they will kill it.
Well, I don't think they can't. I mean, it's out of their control. They would kill it. They would actually prefer to kill it because if it's static, then they can control it, and it's not static, and therefore they can't control it. But let's get into a couple other things. Because they did some things to stop you, and I'd like you to tell the listeners what they did to shut you up.
Well, I started with initial grievances across the board on things from safety to pay to war risk bonus. You know, this is right after 9/11. We're actually in Israel bringing jet fuel over there, JP-5 and JP-8 under Navy contract. all sorts of other things. I tried to stop an explosion before it happened, tried to stop dumping of hazardous materials, et cetera, et cetera. Tried to follow the grievance process that is a line item in federal contracts. And these aren't just normal federal contracts. They're constitutional in nature because of who and what we are, protected by general maritime and admiralty law, which is constitutional.
Uh-huh.
And I don't mean Bill of Rights constitutional. I mean it's in the Constitution, because general maritime and admiralty law came before the Constitution and was embedded in it because our founding fathers understood how gravely important it was to a maritime nation such as ours to protect that right jealously.
Mm-hmm.
And so what's gone on is not only did I try to attempt to, and most of this was to, they were legitimate grievances, trying to get at that core system, understanding that for us as federal maritime officers, whether it be an issue of leave because my father is dying or is ill, and being able to care for my family so that somebody couldn't say, go run over my father so that I would have to deal with that and then have to quit a job so that they could get in and take that job and then be in position to where they could allow or encourage smuggling,
mm-hmm.
or labor racketeering or other types of, that's why we're supposed to be well protected, well provisioned for, and Congress has seen to this to such an extent that we're considered wards under admiralty to the courts and to Congress, because our rights don't come from a federal contracting officer, they come from Congress.
Right, and they did that intentionally because they wanted to know that there were sort of independent agents who would stand up for the fact that the maritime industry is one that is an adjunct of government.
Yes, and that it's one of those that is almost inseparable from government, and it's supposed to be highly regulated, because not only as to issues of tariff and taxes and imports and duties, but suitcase nukes, Typhoid Mary being smuggled in or finding her way on a ship, smuggled slaves or sex slaves within containers, and this happens on a regular basis.
I know, and of course, that would be inconvenient for people who are trying to engage in that sort of quote-unquote commerce.
To have individuals like me embedded there to where we're well-protected and provisioned for and can protect and defend ourselves, and that's why we were also given the statutory right to go in, and constitutional right to go into federal, state, federal district court. We even have original subject matter jurisdiction in circuit appellate and even the Supreme Court. That's all been stripped from us without changing the law, and this has been done administratively, so that we can go and not only protect our waterbound borders, but our shipping articles. And the main reason for this is because of even something like the Exxon Valdez is preventable if people have the avenue to seek and find redress.
And so what this does is that when you became a threat to the petroleum industry, which obviously you were, they decided they were going to go get you.
Well, it was the shipping industry. It's vertical integration is an understatement for what's going on in the maritime industry.
Right. And of course, if you're going to have, you know, petroleum the way that it's transported, you're going to have to involve the maritime industry. That's very clear.
Right. Well, 97% of most cargo goes by ship.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even to Hawaii, the majority goes by ship. You get people flying over. You get one day or two day, cargo that needs to get there quickly, whether it be organs or mail or other things that go by plane. But still, the majority of cargo goes, you know, traditionally now through intermodalism by container.
Mm-hmm. So that makes it a very different industry.
Yes, in a very specialized industry, like even trying to discuss some of these topics that we're covering today, they're very specific, and even understanding what the Merchant Marine is and what we do and how we're trained is an enormous amount of knowledge. You know, it's a $180,000 education all paid for by the federal government, trying to convey some of these issues. Even in the Merchant Marine Act of 1936, we were given access to any and all legislators. Just in case you're in the Merchant Marine, but you live in a landlocked state, and your senators or congressmen don't know about the Merchant Marine,
mm-hmm.
or they're not on the maritime, Commerce Committee.
That's fascinating. And it's very clear that this would be something that needed to be suborned, that is not so sort of unfamiliar to most mainstream Americans that it could happen just the way you've said it did. Now, they actually did, just put you in a hotel room. I mean, they simply incarcerated you illegally.
Right. I actually filed civil suits in federal district courts against the shipping companies and the Federal Officers Association to correct the shipping articles and to address them, and most importantly, the Licensed Personnel Board. And in retaliation, they held on to me, held me in federal district courts, basically using it as an internment camp for years.
Now, how many years did that go on?
That went on for about 3 years. And then, it's still going on now, but what they eventually did was the shipping companies and Federal Officers Association got Homeland Security, a U.S. Coast Guard officer who was involved in some of the investigations where I tried to stop the explosion before it happened and the dumping and other stuff. He is a regulator to some respect, and he's not supposed to regulate me because I'm not in the Coast Guard. He comes in and charges me 2 years later after they use the shipping companies and Federal Officers Association to rough me up in more ways than one. They charge me with, quote-unquote, being depressed, prosecute me aggressively for it in the face of such grievous injuries and loss that they hope I will, commit suicide or go postal.
Well, and that's a very common strategy on their part. You know, I'm sorry, we've sort of run out of time, and I'd like to go into this more, but we just don't have the time right now. Could you give people your contact information so that they can find out? Do you do a newsletter about what's going on with your case?
I'm trying to get it out more and more, but, obviously with the incredible weight that the federal government can bring to bear on one individual, especially as married with the corporations and protection, indemnity, insurance clubs, and more, it makes it rather difficult. But I do have a website, www.martiallaw911.com, and on there is some information to be able to try to get a hold of me.
Yes, and there will be a book out, and this is a subject that we're not going to let drop because it's obviously so essential.
Yes, and not just the whistleblower issues, but the Merchant Marine and even what's going on within our court system as another public trust that is being fortified and shut down to where individuals, especially people like myself and others who need to have access and timely access, cannot gain it.
Well, thank you for being with us and telling us, and I know that we're all going to follow this, and hopefully you can be back to tell us the next chapter in the story.
I'd love to.
Okay, well, you take care, and thank you so much for being with us today.
Peace. Thank you, Melinda.
God bless.
Bye.
And that's our show for today, Friday, March 16, 2007. Here at The Spiritual Politician, we're working to help individuals find out what's going on and then identify the correct organizing tools for things like government, because we need to send the right message to each other, and it needs to be a message of love. On this show, as we do with all our shows, we end by reading the section of the Declaration of Independence that is America's mission statement. This remains where we want to go today. It's up to each of us to ensure we reach the destination. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, and accordingly all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer, while evils are sufferable, than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evidences a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. This is Melinda Pillsbury Foster coming to you from BBS Radio. God bless the journey that brings us to freedom. And may God be with you every step of the way. Good night.